advice. She would check her mail, and then she would call Alan and tell him what Mr. Gaunt wanted her to do. If you do that, the interior voice said grimly, the Oscar really will stop working, and you know it. Yes, but there was still the question of right and wrong. There was still that. She would call Alan and apologize for being so short with him, and then tell him what Mr. Gaunt wanted of her. Perhaps she would even give him the envelope Mr. Gaunt had given her, the one she was supposed to put in the tin can. Perhaps. Feeling a little better, Polly put her key in the front door of her house, again rejoicing at the ease of this operation, almost without being aware of it, and turned it. The mail was in its usual place on the carpet. Not very much today. Usually there was more junk mail after the post office had taken a day off. She bent and picked it up. A cable TV brochure with Tom Cruise's smiling, impossibly handsome face on the front, one catalog from the Horchow collection and another from the Sharper Image. Also, Polly saw the one letter, and a ball of dread began to grow deep in her stomach. To Patricia Chalmers of Castle Rock, from the San Francisco Department of Child Welfare, from 666 Geary. She remembered 666 Geary so very well from her trips down there. Three trips in all. Three interviews with three aid to dependent children bureaucrats, two of whom had been men. Men who had looked at her the way you looked at a candy wrapper that had gotten stuck on one of your best shoes. The third bureaucrat had been an extremely large black woman, a woman who had known how to listen and how to laugh, and it was from this woman that Polly had finally gotten an approval. But she remembered 666 Geary, second floor, so very, very well. She remembered the way the light from the big window at the end of the hall had lain a long, milky stain on the linoleum. She remembered the echoey sound of typewriters from offices where the doors always stood open. She remembered the cluster of men smoking cigarettes by the sand-filled urn at the far end of the hall, and how they had looked at her. Most of all, she remembered how it had felt to be dressed in her one good outfit. A dark polyester pantsuit, a white silk blouse, legs, nearly nude pantyhose, her low heels. And how terrified and lonely she had felt, for the dim second-floor corridor of 666 Geary seemed to be a place with neither heart nor soul. Her ADC application had finally been approved there, but it was the turndown she remembered, of course. The eyes of the men, how they had crawled across her breasts. They were better dressed than Norval down at the diner, but otherwise, she thought, not really much different. The mouths of the men, how they had pursed in decorous disapproval as they considered the problem of Kelton Chalmers, the bastard offspring of this little trollop, this Janie come lately, who didn't look like a hippie now, oh no, but who would undoubtedly take off her silk blouse and nice pantsuit as soon as she got out of here, not to mention her brassiere, and put on a pair of tight bell-bottom jeans and a tie-dyed blouse that would showcase her nipples. Their eyes said all that and more, and although the response of the department had come in the mail, Polly had known immediately that she would be turned down. She had wept as she left the building on each of those first two occasions, and it seemed to her now that she could remember the acid trickle of each tear as it slid down her cheek, that and the way the people on the street had looked at her. No caring in their eyes, just a certain dull curiosity. She had never wanted to think about those times or that dim second-floor hallway again, but now it was back with her. So clearly she could smell the floor polish, could see the milky reflected light from the big window, could hear the echoey, dreamy sound of old manual typewriters chewing through another day in the bowels of the bureaucracy. What did they want? Dear God, what could the people at 666 Geary want with her at this late date? Tear it up! A voice inside nearly screamed, and the command was so imperative that she came very close to doing just that. She ripped the envelope open instead. There was a single sheet of paper inside. It was a Xerox, and although the envelope had been addressed to her, she saw with astonishment that the letter was not. It was addressed to Sheriff Alan Pangborn. Her eyes dropped to the foot of the letter. The name typed below the scrawled signature was John L. Perlmutter, and this name rang a very faint bell for her. Her eyes dropped a little further, and she saw, at the very foot of the letter, the notation CC Patricia Chalmers. Well, this was a Xerox, not a carbon, but it still cleared up the puzzling matter of this being Alan's letter, and settled her first confused idea that it had been delivered to her by mistake. But what, in God's name? Polly sat on the shaker bench in the hallway and began to read the letter. As she did so, a remarkable series of emotions lensed across her face, like cloud formations on an unsettled, windy day. Puzzlement, understanding, shame, horror, anger, and finally, fury. She screamed aloud once, "No!" and then went back and forced herself to read the letter again, slowly, all the way to the end. San Francisco Department of Child Welfare, 666 Geary Street, San Francisco, California, 94112, September 23, 1991. Sheriff Alan J. Pangborn, Castle County Sheriff's Office, 2 The Municipal Building, Castle Rock, Maine, 04055. Dear Sheriff Pangborn, I am in receipt of your letter of September 1 and am writing to tell you I can offer you no help whatever in this matter. It is the policy of this department to give out information on applicants for Aid to Dependent Children, ADC, only when we are compelled to do so by a valid court order. I have shown your letter to Martin D. Chung, our chief legal counsel, who instructs me to tell you that a copy of your letter has been forwarded to the California Attorney General's office. Mr. Chung has asked for an opinion as to whether your request may be illegal in and of itself. Whatever the result of that inquiry, I must tell you that I find your curiosity about this woman's life in San Francisco to be both inappropriate and offensive. I suggest, Sheriff Pangborn, that you lay this matter to rest before you incur legal difficulties. Sincerely, John L. Perlmutter, Deputy Director, CC, Patricia Chalmers. After her fourth reading of this terrible letter, Polly rose from the bench and walked into the kitchen. She walked slowly and gracefully, more like one who swims than one who walks. At first, her eyes were dazed and confused, but by the time she had taken the handset from the wall-mounted phone and tapped out the number of the sheriff's office on the oversized pads, they had cleared. The look which lit them was simple and unmistakable, an anger so strong it was nearly hate. Her lover had been sniffing around in her past. She found the idea simultaneously unbelievable and strangely, hideously plausible. She had done a lot of comparing herself to Alan Pangborn in the last 4 or 5 months, and that meant she had done a lot of coming off second best. His tears, her deceptive calm, which hid so much shame and hurt and secret, defiant pride. His honesty, her little stack of lies, how saint-like he had seemed, how dauntingly perfect, how hypocritical her own insistence that he put the past away. And all the time, he had been sniffing around, trying to find out the real story of Kelton Chalmers. "You bastard," she whispered, and as the telephone began to ring, the knuckles of the hand holding the telephone turned white with strain. Lester Pratt usually left Castle Rock High in the company of several friends. They would all go down to Hemp Hill's Market for sodas, then head off to someone's house or apartment for a couple of hours to sing hymns or play games or just shoot the bull. Today, however, Lester left school alone with his knapsack on his back. He disdained the traditional teacher's briefcase and his head down. If Alan had been there to watch Lester walk slowly across the school lawn toward the faculty parking lot, he would have been struck by the man's resemblance to Brian Rusk. 3 times that day, Lester had tried to get in touch with Sally to find out what in the land of Goshen had made her so mad. The last time had been during his Period 5 lunch break. He knew she was at the middle school, but the closest he got to her was a callback from Mona Lawless, who taught 6th and 7th grade math and chummed with Sally. "She can't come to the phone," Mona told him, displaying all the warmth of a deep freeze stuffed with popsicles. "Why not?" he had asked, almost whined. "Come on, Mona, give." "I don't know." Mona's voice had progressed from popsicles in the deep freeze to the verbal equivalent of liquid nitrogen. All I know is that she's been staying with Irene Lutjens. She looks like she spent all last night crying, and she says she doesn't want to talk to you. And this is all your fault, Mona's frozen tone said. I know that because you're a man, and all men are dog shit. This is just another specific example illustrating the general case. Well, I don't have the slightest idea what it's all about, Lester shouted. Will you tell her that, at least? Tell her I don't know why she's mad at me. Tell her whatever it is, it must be a misunderstanding, because I don't get it. There was a long pause. When Mona spoke again, her voice had warmed up a little. Not much, but it was a lot better than liquid nitrogen. All right, Lester. I'll tell her. Now he raised his head, half hoping Sally might be sitting in the passenger seat of the Mustang, ready to kiss and make up. But the car was empty. The only person close to it was soft-headed Slopey Dodd, goofing around on his skateboard. Steve Edwards came up behind Lester and clapped him on the shoulder. Les boy, want to come over to my place for coke? A bunch of the guys said they'd drop by. We have to talk about this outrageous Catholic harassment. The big meeting's at the church tonight, don't forget, and it would be good if we YAs could present a united front when it comes to deciding what to do. I mentioned the idea to Don Hemphill, and he said, yeah, great, go for it. He looked at Lester as if he expected a pat on the head. I can't this afternoon, Steve. Maybe another time. Hey, Les, don't you get it? There may not be another time. The Pope's boys aren't fooling around anymore. I can't come over, Les said. And if you're wise, his face said, you'll stop pushing it. Well, but why not? Because I have to find out what the heck I did to make my girl so angry, Lester thought. And I am going to find out, even if I have to shake it out of her. Out loud, he said, I've got stuff to do, Steve. Important stuff. Take my word for it. If this is about Sally, Les... Lester's eyes flashed dangerously. You just shut up about Sally. Steve, an inoffensive young man who had been set aflame by the strife over casino night, was not yet burning brightly enough to overstep the line Lester Pratt had so clearly drawn. But neither was he quite ready to give up. Without Lester Pratt, a young adult's policy meeting was a joke, no matter how many from the YA group turned out. Pitching his voice more reasonably, he said, You know the anonymous card Bill got? Yes, Lester said. Reverend Rose had found it on the floor of the parsonage front hallway, the already notorious Baptist Ratfuck card. The Reverend had passed it around at a hastily called Guys Only, YA meeting, because, he said, it was impossible to credit unless you saw the vile thing for yourself. It was hard to fully understand, Reverend Rose had added, the depths to which the Catholics would sink in order to stifle righteous opposition to their Satan-inspired night of gambling. Perhaps actually seeing this vile spew of filth would help these fine young men comprehend what they were up against. For do we not say that to forewarn is forearmed? Reverend Rose had finished grandly. He then produced the card. It was inside a baggie, as if those who handled it needed to be guarded from infection, and handed it around. As Lester finished reading it, he had been more than ready to ring a few sets of Catholic chimes, but now the entire affair seemed distant and somehow childish. Who really cared if the Catholics gambled for play money and gave away a few new tires and kitchen appliances? When it came down to a choice between the Catholics and Sally Ratcliffe, Lester knew which one he had to worry about. A meeting to try and work out the next step, Steve was continuing. He was starting to get hot again. We have to seize the initiative here, Les. We have to. Reverend Bill says he's worried that these so-called concerned Catholic men are through talking. Their next step may be, look, Steve, do whatever you want, but leave me out of it. Steve stopped and stared at him, clearly shocked, and just as clearly expecting Lester, normally the most even-tempered of fellows, to come to his senses and apologize. When he realized no apology was forthcoming, he started to walk back toward the school, putting distance between himself and Lester. Boy, you're in a rotten mood, he said. That's right, Lester called back truculently. He rolled his big hands into fists and planted them on his hips. But Lester was more than just angry. He hurt, damn it. He hurt all over. And what hurt the worst was his mind, and he wanted to strike out at someone, Not poor old Steve Edwards. It was just that allowing himself to get pissed at Steve seemed to have turned on a switch inside him. That switch had sent electricity flowing to a lot of mental appliances which were usually dark and silent. For the first time since he'd fallen in love with Sally, Lester, normally the most placid of men, felt angry at her, too. What right had she to tell him to go to hell? What right did she have to call him a bastard? She was mad about something, was she? All right, she was mad. Maybe he had even given her something to be mad about. He hadn't the slightest idea what that something might be, but say, just for the sake of argument, that he had. Did that give her the right to fly off the handle at him without even doing him the courtesy of asking for an explanation first? Did it give her the right to stay with Irene Lutgen so he couldn't crash his way into wherever she was, or to refuse all his telephone calls, or to employ Mona Lawless as a go-between? I'm going to find her, Lester thought, and I'm going to find out what's eating her. Then, once it's out, we can make up. And after we do, I'm going to give her the same lecture I give my freshmen when basketball practice starts, about how trust is the key to teamwork. He stripped off his pack, chucked it into the back seat, and climbed into his car. As he did, he saw something sticking out from under the passenger seat. Something black. It looked like a wallet. Lester seized it eagerly, thinking at first that it must be Sally's. If she had left it in his car at some point during the long holiday weekend, she must have missed it by now. She'd be anxious. And if he could relieve her anxiety about her lost wallet, the rest of their conversation might become a little easier. But it wasn't Sally's. He saw that as soon as he got a close look at the item which had been under the passenger seat. It was black leather. Sally's was scuffed blue suede and much smaller. Curiously, he opened it. The first thing he saw struck him like a hard blow to the solar plexus. It was John LaPointe's driver's license. What, in the name of God, had John LaPointe been doing in his car? Sally had it all weekend, his mind whispered. So just what the hell do you think he was doing in your car? No, he said. No way. She wouldn't. She wouldn't see him. No way in hell. But she had seen him. She and Deputy John LaPointe had gone out together for over a year, in spite of the developing bad feelings between Castle Rock's Catholics and Baptists. They had broken up before the current hoorah over casino night, but... Lester got out of the car again and flipped through the wallet's see-through pockets. His sense of incredulity grew. Here was LaPointe's sheriff's office ID. In the picture on it, he was wearing the little mustache he'd cultivated when he'd been going out with Sally. Lester knew what some fellows called mustaches like that. Pussy ticklers. Here was John LaPointe's fishing license. Here was a picture of John LaPointe's mother and father. Here was his hunting license. And here? Here? Lester stared fixedly at the snapshot he'd come upon. It was a snapshot of John and Sally. A snap of a fellow and his best girl. They were standing in front of what looked like a carnival shooting gallery. They were looking at each other and laughing. Sally was holding a big stuffed teddy bear. LaPointe had probably just won it for her. Lester stared at the picture. A vein had risen in the center of his forehead, quite a prominent one, and it pulsed steadily. What had she called him? A cheating bastard? Well, look who's talking, Lester Pratt muttered. Rage began to build up in him. It happened very quickly, and when someone touched him on the shoulder, he swung around, dropping the wallet and doubling up his fists. He came very close to punching inoffensive, stuttering Slopey Dodd into the middle of next week. Coach Pratt? Slopey asked. His eyes were big and round, but he didn't look frightened. Interested, but not frightened. Are you okay? I'm fine. Lester said thickly. Go home, Slopey. Put an egg in your shoe and beat it. You don't have any business with that skateboard in the faculty parking lot. He bent down to pick up the dropped wallet, but Slopey was 2 feet closer to the ground and beat him to it. He looked curiously at LaPointe's driver's license photo before handing the wallet back to Coach Pratt. Yep, Slopey said. That's the same guy, all right. He hopped onto his board and prepared to ride away. Lester grabbed him by the shirt before he could do so. The board squirted out from under Slopey's foot, rolled away on its own, hit a pothole, and turned over. Slopey's AC/DC shirt, "For those about to rock, we salute you," it said. Tore at the neck, but Slopey didn't seem to mind. Didn't even seem to be much surprised by Lester's actions, let alone frightened. Lester didn't notice. Lester was beyond noticing nuances. He was one of those large and normally placid men who own a short, nasty temper beneath that placidity, a damaging emotional tornado in waiting. Some men go through their entire lives without ever discovering that ugly storm center. Lester, however, had discovered his, or rather, it had discovered him, and he was now completely in its grip. Holding a swatch of Slopey's T-shirt in a fist which was nearly the size of a daisy-canned ham, he bent his sweating face down towards Slopey's. The vein in the center of his forehead was pulsing faster than ever. "What do you mean, that's the same guy, all right?" "He's the same guy who met Miss Ratcliffe after school last Friday."
"He met her after school?"
Lester asked hoarsely. He gave Slopey a shake brisk enough to rattle the boy's teeth in his head. "Are you sure of that?" "Yeah," Slopey said. "They went off in your car, Coach Pratt. The guy was driving."
"Driving? He was driving my car? John LaPointe was driving my car with Sally in it?"
"Well, that guy," Slopey said, pointing at the driver's license photograph again. "But before they got in, he gave her kiss."
"Did he?" Lester said. His face had become very still. "Did he now?"
"Oh, sure. Slopey said. A wide and rather salacious grin lit his face.
In a soft, silky tone, utterly unlike his usual rough, "Hey guys, let's go get 'em" voice, Lester asked, "And did she kiss him back? What do you think, Slopey?"
Slopey rolled his eyes happily.
"I'll say she did. They were really sucking face, Coach Pratt."
"Sucking face," Lester mused in his new soft and silky voice.
"Yep."
"Really sucking face," Lester marveled in his new soft and silky voice.
"You bet."
Lester let go of the Slopester, as his friends called him, and straightened up. The vein in the center of his forehead was pulsing and pumping away. He had begun to grin. It was an unpleasant grin, exposing what seemed like a great many more white, square teeth than a normal man should have. His blue eyes had become small, squinty triangles. His crew cut screamed off his head in all directions.
"Coach Pratt?" Slopey asked. "Is something wrong?"
"Nope," Lester Pratt said in his new soft and silky voice. His grin never wavered. "Nothing I can't put right." In his mind, his hands were already locked around the neck of that lying, pope-loving, teddy-bear-winning, girl-stealing, shit-eating French frog of a John LaPointe. The asshole that walked like a man. The asshole who had apparently taught the girl Lester loved. The girl who would do no more than part her lips the tiniest bit when Lester kissed her, how to really suck face. First, he would take care of John LaPointe. No problem there. Once that was done, he'd have to talk to Sally. Or something. "Not a thing in the world I can't put right," he repeated in his new soft and silky voice, and slid back behind the Mustang's wheel. The car leaned appreciably to the left as Lester's 210 pounds of solid hock and loin settled into the bucket seat. He started the engine, gunned it in a series of hungry tiger cage roars, then drove away in a screech of rubber. The Slopester, coughing and theatrically waving dust away from his face, walked over to where his skateboard lay. The neck of his old T-shirt had been torn completely away from the shirt's body, leaving what looked like a round black necklace lying over Slopey's prominent collarbones. He was grinning. He had done just what Mr. Gaunt had asked him to do, and it had gone like gangbusters. Coach Pratt had looked madder than a wet hen. Now he could go home and look at his teapot. I just wish I didn't have to stutter, he remarked to no one in particular. Slopey mounted his skateboard and rode away. Sheila had a hard time connecting Alan with Henry Payton. Once she was positive she'd lost Henry, who sounded really excited, and would have to call him back. And she had no more than accomplished this technological feat when Alan's personal line lit up. Sheila put aside the cigarette she'd been about to light and answered it. Castle County Sheriff's Office, Sheriff Pangborn's line. Hello, Sheila. I want to talk to Alan. Polly? Sheila frowned. She was sure that was who it was, but she had never heard Polly Chalmers sound exactly as she did now, cold and clipped, like an executive secretary in a big company. Is that you? Yes, Polly said. I want to talk to Alan. Gee, Polly, you can't. He's talking with Henry Payton right now. Put me on hold, Polly interrupted. I'll wait. Sheila began to feel flustered. Well, I would, but it's a little more complicated than that. You see, Alan's... You know, in the field, I had to patch Henry through. If you can patch Henry Payton through, you can patch me through, Polly said coldly. Right? Well, yes, but I don't know how long they'll be. I don't care if they talk until hell freezes over, Polly said. Put me on hold, and when they're done, patch me through to Alan. I wouldn't ask you to do it if it weren't important. You know that, Sheila, don't you? Yes, Sheila knew it, and she knew something else, too. Polly was beginning to scare her. Polly, are you okay? There was a long pause. Then Polly answered with a question of her own. Sheila, did you type any correspondence for Sheriff Pangborn that was addressed to the Department of Child Welfare in San Francisco, or see any envelopes addressed that way go out? Red lights, a whole series of them, suddenly went on in Sheila's mind. She nearly idolized Alan Pangborn, and Polly Chalmers was accusing him of something. She wasn't sure what, but she knew the tone of accusation when she heard it. She knew it very well. That isn't the sort of information I could give out to anyone, she said, and her own tone had dropped 20 degrees. I suppose you'd better ask the sheriff, Polly. Yes, I guess I'd better. Put me on hold and connect me when you can, please. Polly, what's wrong? Are you angry at Alan? Because you must know he'd never do anything that was... I don't know anything anymore. Polly said. If I asked you something that was out of line, I'm sorry. Now will you put me on hold and connect me as soon as you can, or do I have to go out and find him for myself? No, I'll connect you, Sheila said. Her heart felt strangely troubled, as if something terrible had happened. She, like many of the women in Castle Rock, had believed Alan and Polly were deeply in love, and like many of the other women in town, Sheila tended to see them as characters in a dark-tinged fairy tale where everything would come right in the end. Somehow, love would find a way. But now Polly sounded more than angry. She sounded full of pain and something else as well. To Sheila, the something else sounded almost like hate. You're going on hold now, Polly. It may be a while. That's fine. Thanks, Sheila. Welcome. She pushed the hold button and then found her cigarette. She lit it and dragged deeply, looking at the small, flickering light with a frown. Alan? Henry Payton called. Alan, you there? His voice had the flat, nasal quality voices always have when they are coming through a patch. He sounded like an announcer broadcasting from inside a large, empty saltines box. Right here, Henry. I got a call from the FBI just half an hour ago, Henry said from inside his cracker box. We caught an incredibly lucky break on those prints. Alan's heartbeat kicked into a higher gear. The ones on the doorknob of Nettie's house? The partials? Right. We have a tentative match with a fellow right there in town. One prior, petting larceny in 1977. We've also got his service prints. Now don't keep me hanging. Who is it? The name of the individual is Hugh Albert Priest. Hugh Priest? Alan exclaimed. He could not have been more surprised if Payton had named J. Danforth Quayle. To the best of Alan's knowledge, the two men had known Nettie Cobb equally well. Why would Hugh Priest kill Nettie's dog, or break Wilma Jerzyk's windows, for that matter? I don't know the gentleman, so I can't say, Henry replied. Why don't you pick him up and ask him?
In fact, why don't you do it right away before he gets nervous and decides to visit relatives in Dry Hump, South Dakota? Good idea, Alan said. I'll talk to you later, Henry. Thanks. Just keep me updated, Scout. This is supposed to be my case, you know. Yeah, I'll talk to you. There was a sharp, metallic sound. Bink! As the connection broke, and then Alan's radio was transmitting the open hum of a telephone line. Alan wondered briefly what 9X and AT&T would think of the games they were playing, then bent to rack the mic. As he did so, the telephone line hum was broken by Sheila Brigham's voice, her uncharacteristically hesitant voice. Sheriff, I have Polly Chalmers on hold. She's asked to be patched through to you as soon as you're available. 10-4? Alan blinked. Polly? He was suddenly afraid, the way you're afraid when the telephone rings at 3 a.m. Polly had never asked for such a service before, and if asked, Alan would have said she never would. It would have gone against her idea of correct behavior, and to Polly, correct behavior was very important. What is it, Sheila? Did she say 10-4? No, Sheriff, 10-4. No, of course she hadn't. He had known that, too. Polly didn't spread her business around. The fact that he'd even asked showed how surprised he was. Sheriff? Patch her through, Sheila. 10-4. 10:40, Sheriff. Bink! He stood there in the sunshine, his heart beating too hard and too fast. He didn't like this. The bink sound came again, followed by Sheila's voice, distant, almost lost. Go ahead, Polly. You should be connected. Alan? The voice was so loud he recoiled. It was the voice of a giant. An angry giant. He knew that much already. One word was enough. I'm here, Polly. What is it? For a moment, there was only silence. Somewhere, deep within it, was the faint mutter of other voices on other calls. He had time to wonder if he had lost the connection, time to almost hope he had. Alan, I know this line is open, she said, but you'll know what I'm talking about. How could you? How could you? Something was familiar about this conversation. Something. Polly, I'm not understanding you. Oh, I think you are, she replied. Her voice was growing thicker, harder to understand, and Alan realized that if she wasn't crying, she soon would be. It's hard to find out you don't know a person you thought you did. It's hard to find out the face you thought you loved is only a mask. Something familiar, right, and now he knew what it was. This was like the nightmares he'd had following the deaths of Annie and Todd, the nightmares in which he stood on the side of the road and watched them go past in the Scout. They were on their way to die. He knew it, but he was helpless to change it. He tried to wave his arms, but they were too heavy. He tried to shout and couldn't remember how to open his mouth. They drove by him as if he were invisible, and this was like that, too, as if he had become invisible to Polly in some weird way. Annie, he realized with horror whose name he had said and backtracked. Polly, I don't know what you're talking about, Polly, but... You do! She screamed at him suddenly. Don't say you don't when you do! Why couldn't you wait for me to tell you, Alan? And if you couldn't wait, why couldn't you ask? Why did you have to go behind my back? How could you go behind my back? He shut his eyes tight in an effort to catch hold of his racing, confused thoughts, but it did no good. A hideous picture came instead. Mike Horton from the Norway Journal Register bent over the newspaper's Bearcat scanner, furiously taking notes in his pigeon shorthand. I don't know what it is you think I've done, but you've got it wrong. Let's get together. Talk. No, I don't think I can see you now, Alan. Yes, you can, and you're going to. I'll be... Then Henry Payton's voice cut in. Why don't you do it right away before he gets nervous and decides to visit relatives in Dry Hump, South Dakota? You'll be what? She was asking. You'll be what? I just remembered something, Alan said slowly. Oh, did you? Was it a letter you wrote at the beginning of September, Alan? A letter to San Francisco? I don't know what you're talking about, Polly. I can't come now because there's been a break in the other thing. But later... She spoke to him through a series of gasping sobs that should have made her hard to understand, but didn't. Don't you get it, Alan? There is no later. Not anymore. You... Polly, please. No. Just leave me alone. Leave me alone, you snooping, prying son of a bitch! Bink! And suddenly, Alan was listening to that open telephone line hum again. He looked around the intersection of Main and School like a man who doesn't know where he is and has no clear understanding of how he got there. His eyes had the faraway, puzzled expression often seen in the eyes of fighters in the last few seconds before their knees come unhinged and they go sprawling to the canvas for a long winter's nap. How had this happened? And how had it happened so quickly? He hadn't the slightest idea. The whole town seemed to have gone slightly nuts in the last week or so, and now Polly was infected, too. Bink! Sheriff? It was Sheila, and Alan knew from her hushed, tentative tone that she'd had her ears on during at least part of his conversation with Polly. Alan, are you there? Come back? He felt a sudden urge, amazingly strong, to rip the mic out of its socket and throw it into the bushes beyond the sidewalk, then drive away, anywhere, just stop thinking about everything and drive down the sun. Instead, he gathered all his forces and made himself think of Hugh Priest. That's what he had to do, because it now looked as if maybe Hugh had brought about the deaths of two women. Hugh was his business right now, not Polly, and he discovered a great sense of relief hiding in that. He pushed the transmit button. Here, Sheila. 10-4. Alan, I think I lost the connection with Polly. I didn't mean to listen, but... That's okay, Sheila. We were done. There was something horribly final about what he just said, but he refused to think of it now. Who's there with you right now? 10-4? John's catching, Sheila said, obviously relieved at the turn in the conversation. Klutz out on patrol, near Castle View, according to his last 10-20. Okay. Polly's face, suffused with alien anger, tried to swim to the surface of his mind. He forced it back and concentrated on Hugh Priest again. But for one terrible second, he could see no faces at all, only an awful blankness. Alan, you there, 10-4? Yes, you bet. Call Klutz and tell him to get on over to Hugh Priest's house near the end of Castle Hill Road. He'll know where. I imagine Hugh's at work, but if he does happen to be taking the day off, I'll want Klutz to pick him up and bring him in for questioning. 10-4? 10-4, Alan. Tell him to proceed with extreme caution. Tell him Hugh is wanted for questioning in the deaths of Nettie Cobb and Wilma Jerzyk. He should be able to fill in the rest of the blanks for himself. 10-4. Oh! Sheila sounded both alarmed and excited. 10-4, Sheriff. I'm on my way to the town motor pool. I expect to find Hugh there. 10:40 over and out. As he racked the mic, it felt as if he had been holding it for at least 4 years, he thought. If you told Polly what you just put on the air to Sheila, this situation you've got on your hands might be a little less nasty. Or it might not. How could he tell such a thing when he didn't know what the situation was? Polly had accused him of prying, of snooping. That covered a lot of territory, none of it mapped. Besides, there was something else. Telling the dispatcher to put out a pickup and hold was part of what the job was all about. So was making sure your field officers knew that the man they were after might be dangerous. Giving out the same information to your girlfriend on an open radio telephone patch was a different matter entirely. He had done the right thing, and he knew it. This did not quiet the ache in his heart, however, and he made another effort to focus his mind on the business ahead. Finding Hugh Priest, bringing him in, getting him a goddamn lawyer if he wanted one, and then asking him why he had stuck a corkscrew into Nettie's dog, Raider. For a moment it worked, but as he started the station wagon's engine and pulled away from the curb, it was still Polly's face, not Hugh's, he saw behind his eyes. At about the same time Alan was heading across town to arrest Hugh Priest, Henry Beaufort was standing in his driveway and looking at his Thunderbird. The note he'd found under the windshield wiper was in one hand. The damage the chicken shit bastard had done to the tires was bad, but the tires could be replaced. It was the scratch he had drawn along the car's right-hand side that really toasted Henry's ass. He looked at the note again and read it aloud. Don't you ever cut me off and then keep my car keys, you damn frog. Who had he cut off lately? Oh, all kinds of people. A night when he didn't have to cut someone off was a rare night indeed. But cut off and car keys kept on the board behind the bar? Only one of those just lately. Only one. You motherfucker, the Mellow Tiger's owner and operator said in a soft, reflective voice. You stupid, crazy, motherfucking son of a bitch. He thought about going back inside to get his deer rifle and then thought better of it. The Tiger was just up the road, and he kept a rather special box under the bar. Inside it was a double-barreled Winchester shotgun sawed off at the knees. He'd kept it there ever since that numb fuck Ace Merrill had tried to rob him a few years back. It was a highly illegal weapon, and Henry had never used it. He thought he might just use it today. He touched the ugly scratch Hugh had laid into the side of his T-Bird, then crumpled up the note and tossed it aside. Billy Tupper would be up at the Tiger by now, sweeping the floor and swamping out the heads. Henry would get the sod off, then borrow Billy's Pontiac. It seemed he had a little asshole hunting to do. Henry kicked the balled-up note into the grass. You've been taking those stupid pills again, Hugh, but you aren't going to be taking any more after today. I guarantee it. He touched the scratch a final time. He had never been so angry in his whole life. I guarantee it. Henry set off up the road toward the Mellow Tiger, walking fast. In the process of tearing apart George T. Nelson's bedroom, Frank Jewett found half an ounce of coke under the mattress of the double bed. He flushed it down the john, and as he watched it swirl away, he felt a sudden cramp in his belly. He started to unbuckle his pants, then walked back into the trashed bedroom again instead. Frank supposed he had gone utterly crazy, but he no longer cared much. Crazy people did not have to think about the future. To crazy people, the future was a very low priority. One of the few undisturbed things in George T. Nelson's bedroom was a picture on the wall. It was a picture of an old lady. It was in an expensive gold frame, and this suggested to Frank that it was a picture of George T. Nelson's sainted mother. The cramp struck again. Frank removed the picture from the wall and put it on the floor. Then he unbuckled his pants, squatted carefully above it, and did what came naturally. It was the high point of what had been, up till then, a very bad day. Lenny Partridge, Castle Rock's oldest resident and holder of the Boston Post cane, which Aunt Evie Chalmers had once possessed, also drove one of Castle Rock's oldest cars. It was a 1966 Chevrolet Bel Air, which had once been white. It was now a generic smudged no color, call it dirt road gray. It wasn't in very good shape. The glass in the back window had been replaced by a flapping sheet of all-weather plastic some years ago. The rocker panels had rusted out so badly that Lenny could view the road through a complicated lacework of rust as he drove along, and the exhaust pipe hung down like the rotted arm of a man who had died in a dry climate. Also, the oil seals were gone. When Lenny drove the Bel Air, he spread great clouds of fragrant blue smoke out behind him, and the fields he passed on his daily trip into town looked as if a homicidal aviator had just dusted them with paraquat. The Chevy gobbled 3, sometimes 4, quarts of oil a day. This gaudy consumption did not bother Lenny in the least. He bought recycled diamond motor oil from Sonny Jacket in the 5-gallon economy size, and he always made sure that Sonny deducted 10%, his golden ager discount. And because he hadn't driven the Bel Air at a speed greater than 35 miles an hour in the last 10 years, it would probably hold together longer than Lenny himself. While Henry Beaufort was starting up the road to the Mellow Tiger on the other side of the Tin Bridge, almost 5 miles away, Lenny was guiding his rusty Bel Air over the top of Castle Hill. There was a man standing in the middle of the road with his arms held up in an imperial stop gesture. The man was bare-chested and barefooted. He wore only a pair of khaki pants with the fly unzipped, and around his neck a moth-eaten runner of fur. Lenny's heart took a large, wheezy leap in his scrawny chest, and he slammed both of his feet, clad in a pair of slowly disintegrating high tops, down on the brake pedal. It sank almost to the floor with an unearthly moan, and the Bel Air finally stopped less than 3 feet from the man in the road, whom Lenny now recognized as Hugh Priest. Hugh had not so much as flinched. When the car stopped, he strode rapidly around to where Lenny was sitting, hands pressed against the front of his thermal undershirt, trying to catch his breath and wondering if this was the final cardiac arrest.
"Hugh!" he gasped. "Why, what in the tunnel hell are you doing, boy? I almost run you down. I..."
Hugh opened the driver's door and leaned in. The fur stole he was wearing around his neck swung forward, and Lenny flinched back from it. It looked like a half-rotten foxtail with great hunks of fur missing from the hide. It smelled bad. Hugh seized him by the straps of his overalls and hauled him out of the car. Lenny uttered a squawk of terror and outrage.
"Sorry, old-timer," Hugh said in the absent voice of a man who has much greater problems than this one on his mind. "I need your car. Mine's a little under the weather."
"You can't!"
But Hugh most definitely could. He tossed Lenny across the road as if the old fellow were no more than a bag of rags. When Lenny came down, there was a clear snapping sound, and his squawks turned to mournful, hooting cries of pain. He had broken one collarbone and two ribs. Ignoring him, Hugh got behind the wheel of the Chevy, pulled the door shut, and floored the accelerator. The engine let out a scream of surprise, and a blue fog of oil smoke rolled out of the sagging tailpipe. He was rolling down the hill at better than 50 miles an hour before Lenny Partridge could even manage to thrash his way over onto his back. Andy Clutterbuck swung onto Castle Hill Road at approximately 3:35 p.m. He passed Lenny Partridge's old oil guzzler going the other way and didn't give it a thought. Clut's mind was totally occupied with Hugh Priest, and the rusty old Bel Air was just another part of the scenery. Clut didn't have the slightest idea of why or how Hugh might have been involved in the deaths of Wilma and Nettie, but that was all right. He was a foot soldier, and that was all. The whys and hows were someone else's job, and this was one of those days when he was damn glad of it. He did know that Hugh was a nasty drunk whom the years had not sweetened. A man like that might do anything, especially when he was deep in his cups. And he's probably at work anyway, Clut thought, but as he approached the ramshackle house which Hugh called home, he unsnapped the strap on his service revolver just the same. A moment later, he saw the sun twinkling off glass and chrome in Hugh's driveway, and his nerves cranked up until they were humming like telephone wires in a gale. Hugh's car was here, and when a man's car was at home, the man usually was too. It was just a fact of country life. When Hugh had left his driveway on foot, he had turned right, away from town and toward the top of Castle Hill. If Clut had looked in that direction, he would have seen Lenny Partridge lying on the soft shoulder of the road and flopping around like a chicken taking a dust bath, but he didn't look that way. All of Clut's attention was focused on Hugh's house. Lenny's thin, bird-like cries went in one of Clut's ears, directly across his brain without raising the slightest alarm, and out the other. Clut drew his gun before getting out of the cruiser. William Tupper was only 19, and he was never going to be a Rhodes Scholar, but he was smart enough to be terrified by Henry's behavior when Henry came into the empty bar at 4:20 on the last real day of Castle Rock's existence. He was also smart enough to know trying to refuse Henry the keys to his Pontiac would do no good. In his present mood, Henry, who was, under ordinary circumstances, the best boss Billy had ever had, would just knock him down and take them. So for the first, and perhaps the only, time in his life, Billy tried guile. "Henry," he said timidly, "you look like you could use a drink. I know I could. Why don't you let me pour us both a short one before you go?" Henry had disappeared behind the bar. Billy could hear him back there, rummaging around and cursing under his breath. Finally, he stood up again, holding a rectangular wooden box with a small padlock on it. He put the box on the bar and began to pick through the ring of keys he wore at his belt. He considered what Billy had said, began to shake his head, then reconsidered. A drink really wasn't such a bad idea. It would settle both his hands and his nerves. He found the right key, popped the lock on the box, and laid the lock aside on the bar. "Okay," he said, "but if we're going to do it, let's do it right. Chivas, single for you, double for me." He pointed his finger at Billy. Billy flinched. He was suddenly sure Henry was going to add, "But you're coming with me. And don't tell your mother I let you have hard liquor in here. Do you understand me?" "Yes, sir," Billy said, relieved.
He went quickly to get the bottle before Henry could change his mind. I understand you perfect. Deke Bradford, the man who ran Castle Rock's biggest and most expensive operation, Public Works, was utterly disgusted. Nope, he's not here, he told Allen. Hasn't been in all day. But if you see him before I do, do me a favor and tell him he's fired. Why have you held on to him as long as you have, Deke? They were standing in the hot afternoon sunlight outside Town Garage Number 1. Off to the left, a Case Construction and Supply truck was backed up to a shed. Three men were offloading small but heavy wooden cases. A red diamond shape, the symbol for high explosives, was stenciled on each of these. From inside the shed, Allen could hear the whisper of air conditioning. It seemed very odd to hear an air conditioner running this late in the year, but in Castle Rock, this had been an extremely odd week. I kept him on longer than I should, Deke admitted, and ran his hands through his short, graying hair. I did it because I thought there was a good man hiding somewhere inside of him. Deke was one of those short, stocky men, fireplugs with legs, who always looked ready to take a large chomp out of someone's ass. He was, however, one of the sweetest, kindest men Allen had ever met. When he wasn't drunk or too hungover, wasn't nobody in this town work harder for you than Hugh would. And there was something in his face made me think he might not be one of those men who just has to go on drinking until the devil knocks him down. I thought maybe with a steady job he'd straighten up and fly right. But this last week... What about this last week? Man's been going to hell in a handbasket. Looked like he was all the time on something, and I don't necessarily mean booze. It seemed like his eyes sank way back in his head, and he was always looking over your shoulder when you talked to him, never right at you. Also... He started talking to himself. About what? I don't know. I doubt if the other guys do either. I hate to fire a man, but I'd made up my mind on Hugh even before you pulled in here this afternoon. I'm done with him. Excuse me, Deke. Allen went back to the car, called Sheila, and told her Hugh hadn't been at work all day. See if you can reach Clutch, Sheila, and tell him to really watch his ass, and send John out there as a backup. He hesitated over the next part, knowing the caution had resulted in more than a few needless shootings, and then went ahead. He had to. He owed it to the officers in the field. Clut and John are to consider Hugh armed and dangerous. Got it? Armed and dangerous, 10-4. Okay, 10-40, Unit 1 out. He racked the microphone and walked back to Deke. Do you think he might have left town, Deke? Him? Deke cocked his head to one side and spat tobacco juice. Guys like him never leave town until they picked up their last paycheck. Most of them never leave at all. When it comes to remembering what roads lead out of town, guys like you seem to have some sort of forgetting disease. Something caught Deke's eye, and he turned toward the men offloading the wooden crates. Watch what you're doing with those, you guys. You're supposed to be unloading them, not playing pepper with them. That's a lot of bang you got there, Allen said. Hey, 20 cases. We're going to blow a granite jaw top over at the gravel pit out on number 5. The way it looks to me, we'll have enough left over to blow Hugh all the way to Mars if you want to. Why did you get so much? It wasn't my idea. Buster added to my purchase order. God knows why. I can tell you one thing, though. He's going to shit when he sees the electrical bill for this month, unless a cold front moves in. That air conditioner sucks up the juice something wicked, but you got to keep that stuff cool or it sweats. They all tell you this new bang don't do it, but I believe in better safe than sorry. Buster topped your order, Allen mused. Yeah, by 4 or 6 cases. I can't remember which. Wonders will never cease, huh? I guess not. Deke, can I use your office phone? Be my guest. Allen sat behind Deke's desk for a full minute, sweating dark patches beneath the arms of his uniform shirt and listening to the telephone at Polly's house ring again and again and again. At last he dropped the handset back into the cradle. He left the office in a slow walk, head down. Deke was padlocking the door of the dynamite shack, and when he turned to Allen, his face was long and unhappy. There was a good man somewhere inside of Hugh Priest, Allen. I swear to God there was. A lot of times, that man comes out. I've seen it happen before. More often than most people would believe. With Hugh? He shrugged. Uh-uh. No soap. Allen nodded. Are you okay, Allen? You look like you come over funny. I'm fine, Allen said, smiling a little. But it was the truth. He had come over funny. Polly, too. And Hugh.
and Brian Rusk. It seemed as if everyone had come over funny today. Want a glass of water or cold tea? I got some. Thanks, but I better get going. All right, let me know how it turns out. That was something Alan couldn't promise to do, but he had a sickening little feeling in the pit of his stomach that Deke would be able to read all about it for himself in a day or two, or watch it on TV. I'll see you, Deke, was all he said. Lenny Partridge's old Chevy Bel Air pulled into one of the slant parking spaces in front of Needful Things shortly before 4, and the man of the hour got out. Hugh's fly was still unzipped, and he was still wearing the foxtail around his neck. He crossed the sidewalk, his bare feet slapping on the hot concrete, and opened the door. The small silver bell overhead jingled. The only person who saw him go in was Charlie Fortin. He was standing in the doorway of the Western Auto and smoking one of his stinky home-rolled cigarettes. "Old Hugh finally flipped," Charlie said to no one in particular. Inside, Mr. Gaunt looked at old Hugh with a pleasant, expectant little smile, as if barefooted, bare-chested men wearing moth-eaten foxtails around their necks showed up in his shop every day. He made a small check mark on the sheet beside the cash register. The last check mark. "I'm in trouble," Hugh said, advancing on Mr. Gaunt. His eyes rolled from side to side in their sockets like pinballs. "I'm in a real mess this time." "I know," Mr. Gaunt said in his most soothing voice. "This seemed like the right place to come. I don't know. I keep dreaming about you. I didn't know where else to turn."
"This is the right place, Hugh."
"He got my tires,"
Hugh whispered.
"Beaufort, the bastard who owns the Mellow Tiger. He left a note. 'You'll know what I'll come after next time, Hubert,' it said. 'I know what that means. You bet I do.'"
One of Hugh's grubby and large-fingered hands caressed the mangy fur, and an expression of adoration spread across his face. It would have been sappy if it had not been so clearly genuine.
"My beautiful, beautiful foxtail. Perhaps you ought to take care of him," Mr. Gaunt suggested thoughtfully, "before he can take care of you. I know that sounds a little, well, extreme, but when you consider..." Yes, that's just what I want to do."
"I think I have just the thing," Mr. Gaunt said. He bent down, and when he straightened up, he had an automatic pistol in his left hand. He pushed it across the glass top of the case, fully loaded. Hugh picked it up. His confusion seemed to blow away like smoke as the gun's solid weight filled his hand. He could smell gun grease, low and fragrant.
I left my wallet at home," he said.
"Oh, you don't need to worry about that," Mr. Gaunt told him. "At Needful Things, Hugh, we insure the things we sell." Suddenly his face hardened. His lips peeled back from his teeth and his eyes blazed.
"Go get him," he cried in a low, harsh voice. "Go get the bastard that wants to destroy what is yours. Go get him, Hugh. Protect yourself. Protect your property."
Hugh grinned suddenly. "Thanks, Mr. Gaunt. Thanks a lot." "Don't mention it," Mr. Gaunt said, dropping immediately back into his normal tone of voice. But the small silver bell was already jangling as Hugh went back out, stuffing the automatic into the sagging waistband of his trousers as he walked. Mr. Gaunt went to the window and watched Hugh get behind the wheel of the tired Chevy and back it into the street. A Budweiser truck rolling slowly down Main Street blared its horn and swerved to avoid him.
"Go get him, Hugh," Mr. Gaunt said in a low voice.
Small wisps of smoke began to rise from his ears and his hair. Thicker threads emerged from his nostrils and from between the square white tombstones of his teeth.
"Get all of them you can. Party down, big fella."
Mr. Gaunt threw back his head and began to laugh. John LaPointe hurried toward the side door of the sheriff's office, the one that gave on the municipal building parking lot. He was excited, armed and dangerous. It wasn't often you got to assist in arresting an armed and dangerous suspect, not in a sleepy little town like Castle Rock, anyway.
He had forgotten all about his missing wallet, at least for the time being, and Sally Ratcliffe was even further from his mind. He reached for the door just as someone opened it from the other side. All at once, John was facing 220 pounds of angry phys ed coach.
"Just the man I wanted to see," Lester Pratt said in his new, soft and silky voice. He held up a black leather wallet.
"Lose something, you ugly, two-timing, gambling, godless son of a bitch?" John didn't have the slightest idea what Lester Pratt was doing here, or how he could have found his lost wallet. He only knew that he was Klutz's designated backup, and he had to get going right away.
"Whatever it is, I'll talk to you about it later, Lester," John said, and reached for his wallet.
When Lester first pulled it back out of his reach, and then brought it down hard, smacking John in the center of the face with it, he was more astounded than angry.
"Oh, I don't want to talk," Lester said in his new soft and silky voice. "I wouldn't waste my time."
He dropped the wallet, grabbed John by the shoulders, picked him up, and threw him back into the sheriff's office. Deputy LaPointe flew 6 feet through the air and landed on top of Norris Ridgwick's desk. His butt skated across it, plowing a path through the heaped paperwork and knocking Norris's in-out basket onto the floor. John followed, landing on his back with a painful thump. Sheila Brigham was staring through the dispatcher's window, her mouth wide open. John began to pick himself up. He was shaken and dazed, without the slightest clue as to what was going on here. Lester was walking toward him in a fighting strut. His fists were held up in an old-fashioned John L. Sullivan pose that should have been comic, but wasn't.
"I'm going to learn you a lesson," Lester said in his new soft and silky voice. "I'm going to teach you what happens to Catholic fellows who steal Baptist fellows' girls. I'm going to teach you all about it, and when I'm done, you'll have it so right you'll never forget it."
Lester Pratt closed in to teaching distance. Billy Tupper might not have been an intellectual, but he was a sympathetic ear, and a sympathetic ear was the best medicine for Henry Beaufort's rage that afternoon. Henry drank his drink and told Billy what had happened, and as he talked, he felt himself calming down. It occurred to him that if he had gotten the shotgun and just kept rolling, he might have ended this day not behind his bar, but behind those of the holding cell in the sheriff's office. He loved his T-Bird a lot, but he began to realize he didn't love it enough to go to prison for it. He could replace the tires, and the scratch down the side would eventually buff out. As for Hugh Priest, let the law take care of him. He finished the drink and stood up.
"You still going after him, Mr. Beaufort?" Billy asked apprehensively.
"I wouldn't waste my time," Henry said, and Billy breathed a sigh of relief. "I'm going to let Alan Pangborn take care of him. Isn't that what I pay my taxes for, Billy?"
"I guess so."
Billy looked out the window and brightened a little more. A rusty old car, a car which had once been white but was now a faded no-color, call it dirt road gray, was coming up the hill toward the Mellow Tiger, spreading a thick blue fog of exhaust behind it.
"Look, it's old Lenny. I ain't seen him in a coon's age."
"Well, we still don't open until 5, Henry said.
He went behind the bar to use the telephone. The box containing the sawed-off shotgun was still on the bar.
"I think I was planning to use that," he mused. "I think I really was. What the hell gets into people? Some kind of poison?"
Billy walked toward the door as Lenny's old car pulled into the parking lot.
"Lester," John LaPointe began, and that was when a fist almost as large as a daisy-canned ham, but much harder, collided with the center of his face. There was a dirty crunching sound as his nose broke in a burst of horrible pain. John's eyes squeezed shut, and brightly colored sparks of light fountained up in the darkness. He went reeling and flailing across the room, waving his arms, fighting a losing battle to stay on his feet. Blood was pouring out of his nose and over his mouth. He struck the bulletin board and knocked it off the wall. Lester began to walk toward him again, his brow wrinkled into a beetling frown of concentration below his screaming haircut. In the dispatcher's office, Sheila got on the radio and began trying to get Alan. Frank Jewett was on the verge of leaving the home of his good old friend, George T. Nelson, when he had a sudden cautionary thought.
This thought was that when George T. Nelson arrived home to find his bedroom trashed, his coke flushed, and the lightness of his mother beshitted, he might come looking for his old party buddy. Frank decided it would be nuts to leave without finishing what he had started. And if finishing what he had started meant blowing the blackmailing bastard's head off, so be it. There was a gun cabinet downstairs, and the idea of doing the job with one of George T. Nelson's own guns felt like poetic justice to Frank. If he was unable to unlock the gun cabinet or force the door, he would help himself to one of his old party buddy's steak knives and do the job with that. He would stand behind the front door, and when George T. Nelson came in, Frank would either blow his motherfucking head off or grab him by the hair and cut his motherfucking throat. The gun would probably be the safer of the two options, but the more Frank thought of the hot blood jetting from George T. Nelson's slit neck and splashing all over his hands, the more fitting it seemed. Et tu, Georgie. Et tu, you blackmailing fuck. Frank's reflections were disturbed at this point by George T. Nelson's parakeet, Tammy Faye, who had picked the most inauspicious moment of its small avian life to burst into song. As Frank listened, a peculiar and terribly unpleasant smile began to surface on his face. "How did I miss that goddamn bird the first time?" he asked himself as he strode into the kitchen. He found the drawer with the sharp knives in it after a little exploration and spent the next 15 minutes poking it through the bars of Tammy Faye's cage, forcing the small bird into a fluttery, feather-shedding panic before growing bored with the game and skewering it. Then he went downstairs to see what he could do about the gun cabinet. The lock turned out to be a snap, and as Frank climbed the stairs to the first floor again, he burst into an unseasonal but nonetheless cheery song. "Oh, you better not fight, you better not cry, you better not pout, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. He sees you when you're sleeping, he knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good, so you better be good for goodness sake." Frank, who had never failed to watch Lawrence Welk every Saturday night with his own beloved mother, sang the last line in a low Larry Hooper basso. Gosh, he felt good. How could he have ever believed, only an hour or so earlier, that his life was at an end? This wasn't the end. It was the beginning. Out with the old, especially dear old friends like George T. Nelson, and in with the new. Frank settled in behind the door. He was pretty well loaded for bear. There was a Winchester shotgun leaning against the wall, a Lama 32 automatic stuffed into his belt, and an upraised Sheffington steak knife in his hand. From where he stood, he could see the small heap of yellow feathers that had been Tammy Faye. A small grin twitched Frank's Mr. Weatherby mouth, and his eyes, utterly mad eyes now, rolled ceaselessly back and forth behind his round, rimless Mr. Weatherby spectacles.
"You better be good for goodness sake," he admonished under his breath.
He sang this line several times as he stood there, and several more times after he had made himself more comfortable, sitting behind the door with his legs crossed, his back propped against the wall, and his weapons in his lap. He began to feel alarmed at how sleepy he was becoming. It seemed nuts to be on the verge of dozing off when he was waiting to cut a man's throat, but that didn't change the fact. He thought he had read someplace, perhaps in one of his classes at the University of Maine at Farmington, a cow college from which he had graduated with absolutely no honors at all, that a severe shock to the nervous system sometimes had that very effect, and he'd suffered a severe shock, all right. It was a wonder his heart hadn't blown like an old tire when he saw those magazines scattered all over his office. Frank decided it would be unwise to take chances. He moved George T. Nelson's long, oatmeal-colored